Hey everybody, Chris Fafalius here. If you enjoy One Hit Thunder, which I'm assuming you do considering you're listening to it right now, I want to tell you about another great music podcast on the Evergreen Podcast Network. It's called Riffs on Riffs. On this season of Riffs on Riffs, hosts Toby Braswell and Joe Watson are breaking down one iconic pop song each week. Everything from Taylor Swift's Cruel Summer to Journey's Don't Stop Believin' to Naughty by Nature's OPP. Each week, they crack open the song, trace its history, decode those cryptic lyrics, and unearth the hidden gems in its musical DNA. Not only do they dive into the song's history, lyrics, and impact, they also go down some fun and oftentimes hilarious rabbit holes. So yeah, if you're a fan of One Hit Thunder, I think you'll also enjoy Riffs on Riffs. So go hit that subscribe button on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. For some people, Thomas Dolby might be considered only a blip on the 80s music radar. The wild-haired, bespectacled Englishman with the song where someone yells, "Science!" The more knowledgeable music connoisseurs, however, know very well how much influence this new wave icon had and continues to have on legions of electronic music artists. This week, we're joined by Huffamoose drummer Eric Johnson to discuss the long-term impact Dolby has had on music, the unforgettable music video for She Blinded Me with Science, and we even dive into Eric's personal recollections from when Huffamoose played the main stage at Woodstock 94.
One hit is all you need to make the money guaranteed, and you can live off royalties forever.
And it makes me wonder, is it just a wonder, or is it one hit thunder?
Well, hey Eric, welcome to the show. Today we are here to talk about Thomas Dolby, which Thomas Dolby comes up a lot on our podcast, and I really notice every time he does, because Matt, much like Coach Z on Homestar Runner, pronounces it Dolby every time. And every time I point it out to him, he's very much like Coach Z for any Homestar fans. It'd be like, "Hey there, Homestar. Did you check out the new Thomas Dolby album?" He did a great job on it. But I'm glad we're talking about Thomas Dolby today. Eric, you brought this one to the table. And I know we've done a lot of people before. Were you a Thomas Dolby fan in general before this? Or were you just curious?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah, huge. When that tune came out, I think I was like 12 years old. And it just sounded so cool and different that it really attracted my attention. But then in the late 80s, he had a record called Aliens Ate My Buick.
Yep, listen to it today.
I love that record. It's just, and the bass player, I forget his name, but he's actually from Atlantic City. He passed away as far as I know, but he was like an Atlantic City, like working bass player. Monster.
Nice. I was really surprised at so many things when I dove into Thomas Dolby's catalog, because first of all, I thought he was like one of those guys that was like the definition of a one-hit wonder, like had this song that was sort of like a novelty hit. I mean, I think
right.
A big part of this song, which we'll get into, is the, what's the guy's name? Magnus Pike. Just the parts that go, "Science!" Like, I feel like that's very memorable about this song. But I was really pleasantly surprised to see what a long career and prolific career Thomas Dolby has.
So I want to talk about, here's a fun little fact. We're going to jump very far into the story real quick, but I remember VH1 did a TV special similar to like a Where Are They Now, but it was just about one hit wonders. It was just like, they were just like rocking down this list and being like, here's where all these one hit wonders ended up. And Thomas was one of those people that they covered. And at that time, at that moment that they were doing the special, he was the person who essentially created the ringtone of like the 2000s. Yeah. He like cracked the technology. So back in the days when you could buy a ringtone for like 99 cents, the entire time my ringtone in honor of him was She Blinded Me with Science. It was
great.
It was like, and I loved those, like, not where it actually played a song, but it was almost like a chiptune version of the song. Like, it was like using the sound of the ringer to be like, burp, beep, 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 burp, burp.
Phone would ring. Yeah. Well, he had this company called, do you remember what it was called?
Well, it was Headspace at first, and then he changed it to like Beatnik. I want to say it was. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess he had the first polyphonic ringtone, and the Nokia, a famous Nokia ringtone that I can't remember right now.
Oh.
He basically turned it into like a polyphonic thing. And then his Beatnik thing made him probably a lot more money than anything he ever did in the music business.
Wow. I have been falsely for, I don't know, a decade plus, maybe longer than that, falsely giving him credit for like the Dolby surround sound. I feel like that's like a false understanding that a lot of people, I've probably spread that false rumor about him. I think he actually adopted the stage name Dolby because of the Dolby recording technology, right?
So much so, what I saw was that he played around with cassette tapes and like keyboards in the 70s when it wasn't like normal for people to be that invested in those instruments. So someone gave him the nickname of Dolby because he was always using that type of equipment.
Right.
So he went with the stage name because there was already a recording artist named Tom Robinson when he was coming out. And Dolby kind of raised concerns about the name, and the record label was like, well, tough, that's his name. And then years later, they basically came to this conclusion. I think as Thomas started making all this new technology, they were like, you can't name any of your new technology Dolby.
Right.
Like, that was like,
that's funny.
That was like their like agreement, basically.
Right.
So I didn't give Thomas Dolby nearly enough credit for his music, but I gave him way too much credit for the technology he developed.
Yeah.
That's all right.
Yeah, right.
It evens out. But this song, you know, I hadn't listened to this song in a while. Once again, I'm one of those people who just remembered the She Blinded Me with Science, which would, Matt, I got to say, would be one of those fun things like when we did the EMF episode to do the, that would be a fun thing to have a contest of who can do it the loudest at some point. And maybe next time you're out this way, Matt, we can.
Yeah, we'll just yell science at each other around the table for a little bit.
But I kind of forgot how good the melodies in this song were, and maybe had a false memory of this song being a song that was kind of just instrumental and had these, you know, like an Avalanches type thing, Matt, where it was, it was a musical, but no, this is a really good song. And I'm glad that
the lyrics are awesome. I never really sat down and looked at the, like even just the opening line, it's poetry in motion. She turned her tender eyes to me, as deep as any ocean, as sweet as any harmony. Like, it's a really good fucking opening verse.
Yeah.
Very beautiful. He's great. He's a really brilliant musician, actually. I mean, he did stuff with Herbie Hancock and produced some Joni Mitchell stuff. I think he produced Dog Eat Dog.
So
Joni Mitchell record.
I wrote down a few of the cool things that he was a part of even before he was a solo artist. So he worked with this dude, Bruce Willey, Bruce Willey, who, Chris, I don't know if that name strikes a memory in you, but we recently talked about him as one of the original founding members of the Buggles who quit before they recorded their debut album. He was like right involved in that same world that like Trevor Horn was involved in with like really pushing synthesizers. And because of that, he was a studio session synthesize player for like the 70s and 80s, which led to him playing synthesizers for the Thompson Twins, Houdini, and most significantly for Foreigner on the song Urgent. When you listen to that song Urgent by Foreigner, that's all of him playing the synthesizers. He also played synthesizers on Def Leppard's Pyromania and was in David Bowie's backup band at Live Aid.
Yeah.
Wow. That's quite a resume. Thomas Dolby really fits in well with these guys who were like,
you know, just kind of geniuses of harnessing the technology of the era. We recently did that Buggles episode, and, you know, Trevor Horn of the Buggles really buggled my mind with the amount of stuff he's done after. Howard Jones is one of those guys.
Yeah.
You know, to a certain extent, Joe Jackson kind of dove into this kind of stuff. A lot of these people were so, so good at using the technology. And I actually saw an old interview clip of Bjork talking about this recently, how people will try to talk about synthesizers as being soulless. And, you know, but if you use that technology and, you know, it's what you bring as a human to it, it doesn't matter if that's your instrument you're using. There can be a lot of soul in synth.
Yeah.
You know?
I think about in the big hit for him that we're talking about, I think about even the way the synthesizer is used almost for backup vocals in a weird way, where you get that like blinded me with science, like, and it's like a modulated voice through the keyboard to get like these weird melody patterns in the backup vocals. It's really, and it, I'm not sure if he stumbled onto like the fact that his dad was also kind of a genius.
No.
But his dad, Martin Robinson, Robertson, was an internationally distinguished college professor who taught classical Greek art and archaeology at the University of London, Oxford University, and Cambridge throughout his career. In fact, there was a rumor going around for years that Thomas Dolby, even though it's listed,
there it is. Dolby.
Dolby.
That he was born, I mean, he was actually born in London, but for years he actually claimed that he was born in Cairo because his dad was doing an archaeological dig in Egypt around the time that he was born.
Oh, that's funny.
It makes me feel so boring. I feel like I'm
boring.
I know, right? Yeah.
So,
but then, yeah, he has all these. You sent me a dope ass music video that he did for his second big hit.
Yeah, it was incredible. He actually wrote the storyboard for "She Blinded Me with Science" before he wrote the song.
Oh, that's like, kind of awesome
for the video. It was like a reverse sear in a kitchen.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are you saying that there's the possibility, or this is just fact, that he had this music video concept and maybe the song he wrote the song to make the music video to? Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right.
I have never heard of that before. That is insane.
And he still gets a thrill out of listening to the song, but he said something to the effect that it was one of the most trivial songs he ever wrote, because it's about a scientist who falls in love with his lab assistant.
Right.
But it's a hilarious, witty, great song. And I guess it hit just at the right time for, like, I remember watching MTV when I was a kid, and there were all these kind of synthy bands like Berlin. Mm-hmm. They had a tune called The Metro, which was like a pretty big MTV hit for them. And it was all that, like, you know, like the Joe Jackson left hand, stepping out kind of vibe.
Yes. Love it.
Yeah. But Thomas Dolby's thing, the thing about that song, first of all, the song architecture is super cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's like some asymmetrical phrases, and the bridge is like this kind of funky breakdown thing. I don't know. I think sometimes when a song comes out in a particular milieu, it gets lumped in and it's like, oh, that's synth crap.
Right.
You know, but the truth is, if you really get beyond its original context and you listen to the musical architecture, the lyrical content, it's a real gem. I mean, it's a fantastic song.
Yeah.
And super well executed, you know?
I wouldn't really know how to go about starting to write a song like this, minus maybe with the technology of now, it would just be a matter of having fun, just going in the studio and having fun and playing around with a lot of stuff. But I don't think you had as much luxury of that back in the early 80s of, you know, we can open a Logic or Pro Tools session and just kind of like pile things on top of each other. But with what you had available at the time, it's a real feat. I don't know. I couldn't sit down with a guitar and write "She Blinded Me with Science." That would be, you know, that's what's insane about a song like this to me.
And it was like, on some level, you had, you know, Moogs and all the other synths, you know, very early other polyphonic synths that were really fairly primitive, but they were so advanced technologically compared to the medium of, you know, recording this stuff. So it was almost like you had the synthesizer technology wearing the lead boots of analog tape, and it had to, you know, it was like, well, that's our limitation right there. You know, like probably two inch tapes, you know, connected together with SMPTE code. So you could record 48 or probably 46 tracks.
Right.
You know, and I mean, it was, yeah. And, you know, the sequencing was very primitive at that era. Like it was more like the, I think the mid 80s when sequencers started to become more usable. So a lot of it was, you know, played in live.
Right. Not to mention the fact that how expensive some of those synthesizers were. There was that,
oh my God.
There was that one that was used. I always forget what which one it was, but it was the one famously used on like Dancing in the Dark and used on like some of the biggest artists. And those things, when I was looking at them, they go for like 20 to 50 grand now.
Yeah.
Some of those artists, we always see they use that Fairlight computer, it was called.
Yep.
Fairlight something that like
CMI.
Yes, yeah. CMI that Kate Bush was using and the Eurythmics were using. But that stuff, not only so expensive, like you said, but then to record it to tape is, you know, you have to come into there. Once again, it's not like you or I sitting down with a MIDI keyboard in Logic and being able, you got to come in there ready to perform on these things.
Definitely.
So it's pretty mind-blowing what these artists were doing.
And the Synclavier, I guess, was probably the one that was like, it was like $50,000. I mean, a Sting, I remember Sting used to bring one on tour with him, but it was like the Sperry Univac, you know what I mean? It looked like one of those original mainframe computers with all the tiny telephone shit. And I'm like, God,
insane.
It's like a totally burdensome, you know, huge, expensive technology. Now we have it in our phones.
Right.
Well, I think it's interesting because this episode coming so close after the Buggles episode, like it really does make you appreciate how strong of a pioneer a lot of these like late 70s into the early 80s synthesizer guys were, because they saw a possibility that like no one else saw. You know what I mean? Yeah, like most people were like, oh, a synthesizer. So it's like a keyboard it's like a piano that's lighter that I can plug in. And then they're just looking at like, no, look at like the way that you can bend sound, essentially.
Right.
It's like you just manipulate a noise in a way that can never be done before.
There were a couple people that I think of. Like one is Jan Hammer, who first rose to prominence as the keyboard player in the Mahavishnu Orchestra. He did a lot of synth stuff. Like he did a record with Jeff Beck around 1977 called There and Back. And there's tons of program synths and, you know, and he was really famous for his like, like all the Bender stuff.
Uh-huh.
And then he went on to do all the music for Miami Vice.
Oh, nice.
But he, like all the like synth drums, it was all him.
Iconic.
And he, oh my God. Yeah. And he has this unbelievable career playing, you know, jazz, fusion, doing television music. And, you know, he was another guy that was a real pioneer. I also was thinking about Gary Numan, that tune Cars.
He was like the pioneer. That
totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's another one we definitely are probably going to get around to
sooner rather
than later.
I can't believe we haven't done him yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I tried to take a picture of a bumper sticker I saw the other day, but I don't have a strong enough camera, I guess, on my phone that literally just said, Gary Numan is in my car.
That's awesome.
Like what a great bumper sticker.
You know, also, as far as these guys and girls being visionaries and pioneers, I'm still thinking about what you told me about how he had the music video written first. These people were such pioneers with MTV coming around in 1981. Now this song, it peaked in 1983, but it was released in 82. But to be that smart and that forward thinking, knowing that, yo, music videos are what are going to help you rise to prominence. Matt brought this up before, that these new wave artists, they may have been a little bit too much for a lot of people had it not been for the music videos that went along with them. They may have been too weird for people at the time, but the music video really helped push that whole movement to the forefront. And for
no doubt, and
for him to be such a visionary, to be like, I got the music video idea, and then to write the song to go along with that. And oh man, right. so smart,
incredible.
Chris, a couple of minutes ago you threw around the word iconic.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk about the top five year that this song peaked.
Yeah.
Because it may have been the most iconic top five we've had in a really long time here. So this song peaked on the U.S. Billboard chart on May 14th, 1985, just above Come On Eileen by Dexy's Midnight Runner. Also in the top five, we had at number four, Overkill by Men at Work.
Amazing song. My favorite Men at Work song. So good.
Number three, Jeopardy by the Greg Kinn Band.
Did that song? Right. Yeah, it's a great song. But did that one go to number one at some point? I think it may have. Right?
If it didn't, it may have stalled out at number two because of what was at number one for a while, and we'll get there in a second.
Yeah.
And number two was Let's Dance by David Bowie.
Yep.
Another classic. And then the number one song in America was Beat It by Michael Jackson. And the only reason I don't think Jeopardy hit number one is, as I was trying to find where this song peaked on the like very useful Billboard digital thing, it was Billie Jean by Michael Jackson for a long time and then suddenly Beat It. So I think MJ just kept Jeopardy from getting that top spot.
Yeah. I made note of a few other ones on this chart at the time just because how they related to our show. First of all, number 27, another band who was just wild and different than everyone else. I think this was their only real hit. But at number 27 at this time was She's a Beauty from the Tubes.
Nice.
So, love it.
So good. Number 24 at this week was Billie Jean. Going up a little, another one, a band I think falls in this role at number 22 at the time was Naked Eyes with Always Something There to Remind Me, which I never realized until we talked about it that was a cover song. I should have probably realized that. At number 20, Faithfully from Journey. At number 19, now, Eric, this is one of the most controversial episodes we ever did of this, and it was early on. We did a Rick Springfield episode, which was completely ludicrous because at number 19 at this time was Affair of the Heart from Rick Springfield, which that song is awesome.
It's not as good as Jesse's Girl, though.
Well,
I love that song because it's so complicated. Like, it really is. It's like this labyrinthine kind of song structure with like truncated phrases and all this stuff, but it just hits so hard, like as a pop song. And it's the kind of song that you get annihilated on social media by like the cool kids if you talk about Rick Springfield.
Yeah.
but that's a good tune though. I like that. I like the Affair of the Heart.
By the title of it, I was like, wait, which Rick Springfield song is this? So I put it on. I'm like, oh yeah, this is the one. Don't try to tell me it's all physical song. That song's great. And then a couple other ones that also fit, I think, in the same world, like how do you say it? Dirkarmasar? Dirkarmasar?
Yeah.
Falco, right?
After the fire.
After the fire.
Yeah.
After the fire's cover of Falco.
Exactly.
After the fire, I was like, what song is that? And for anyone listening, it is Don't Turn Around.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Shut up.
Solitaire from Laura Branigan was number nine. That was the one song I didn't know. Even when I listened to it, I'm like, I don't know this one. Little Red Corvette from Prince was at number eight.
Yeah.
Flashdance, What a Feeling from Irene Cara was at number seven. Just so many memorable songs. So for She Blinded Me with Science to, you know, really, I would be happy that if I was Thomas Dolby that I peaked at number five to just be in that mix because a lot memorable songs at this time.
And the cool thing is it's like it has like a definite novelty element to it, but not in a like Right Said Fred kind of way that's like, wow, whatever, you know, like a sort of, it had some novelty element, but it was kind of lackluster. But this song is like timeless in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, it takes you.
I'm kind of biased. I love him.
It takes you right to that era for sure.
The
spoken, as I mentioned earlier, the spoken science lines are delivered by Magnus Pike. I was real curious, like, is that just Thomas Dolby doing that in like a voice? But no, it's Magnus Pike, who was an English nutritional scientist, a governmental scientific advisor, a writer, and a presenter. He worked for the UK Ministry of Food, the post-war Allied Commission for Austria, and a bunch of different food manufacturers. But he also did a lot of like television spots on the BBC, was featured on a lot of shows. I think he was a pretty, you know, moderately well-known person in the UK at this time, or maybe years before.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I love that he also dabbled into everything. Like, he didn't just do this music, right? Like, She Blinded Me with Science, the song that we were talking about earlier, Hyperactive, like an absolutely incredible song, bizarre video.
Such a good video. That's the one I sent that video for Hyperactive to Matt earlier. I'm like, both videos feature Thomas Dolby laying on like a therapist couch that happens in both videos. That he was really into that, I guess. But that video for Hyperactive, anybody listening, you gotta watch it. It is so freaking weird. It is Thomas Dolby. There's a bunch of scenes of him with like a puppet on his hand, except the puppet is just a smaller version of him. And it is, and the puppet is like performing the song. It is so weird. People with cubes on their hand, a lot of green screen work, but pretty solid green screen work, I think. And Matt told me that actually that video and song were the inspiration for Weird Al's, which song? Slime Creatures?
Slime Creatures from Outer Space on the Dare to Be Stupid album.
Oh,
the bass line
and
instrumentation is inspired by Hyperactive's bass line and drums.
Hey everyone, this is Tuck from Fit for a King in Off-Road Minivan. Every week I bring you fun interviews alongside your favorite metalcore entertainers with my new podcast, Get Tucked. Join me every Monday with bands like Counterparts, Crystal Lake, like Moths to Flames, and many more. We play unsigned and undiscovered bands, deep dive into each artist's history, and of course provide the greatest breakdowns in current metalcore. Tune in to Get Tucked every Monday, out now through Sound Talent Media.
By now, I'm sure you've at least heard about Factor, but if you haven't tried it yet, let me tell you as a guy who loves it, now is the time. Enjoy stress-free dining this spring with Factor's chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals that are ready in just 2 minutes. With 35 weekly options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie, plus over 60 add-ons, you'll stay fueled and feel fantastic all day long. Don't wait. Fuel up for your spring goals today with Factor. Factor offers you chef-prepared meals ready in just 2 minutes so you can spend more time doing what you love this spring. Indulge in gourmet options like filet mignon, shrimp, and fresh veggies without the hassle of prep or cleanup. Customize your weekly meals to fit your schedule perfectly and enjoy the convenience of Factor's no-fuss, no-mess approach. Plus, you can celebrate Earth Day all month long with Factor's low-carbon footprint options. Factor is your go-to solution for fast, premium meals, eliminating the need for cooking and empowering you to savor every moment. So head to factormeals.com/onehit50 and use the code 150 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code 150, the words one hit and the number 50, at factormeals.com/onehit50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
At Maximum Mediocrity, people say things like,
I don't dress like this on the regular basis. This isn't my, you know, pooping uniform. This is not fair.
And they also say things like,
The nurses are usually either angels of mercy or whores.
Every episode is a new experience where you get to know people that aren't famous but should be.
Why am I facing Floyd Mayweather in the woods?
My co-host Morgan and I track down the people you didn't know you needed to hear from.
It's like hot sex in a mug.
We are the Maximum Mediocrity Podcast, and we are on all major podcasting platforms. We'll be waiting for you.
He also went into, he did film scores and even acted a little bit. Not a ton of hits, unfortunately, but he wrote and performed most of the songs for Howard the Duck in 1986. He also starred in and wrote some songs for the movie Rockula, starring Dean Cameron, and then wrote the songs for Ferngully, The Last Rainforest, and wrote the main song for Toys, the failed Robin Williams movie from 1992.
Wow.
So he was still like, it's kind of impressive to look at his full career because he's just like never, he's not one of those one-hit wonders that we talk about where it's like, dude just like vanished. It was like, dude was a worker. Like, oh, yeah. He kept himself busy throughout all of it.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, that's super admirable. And that's something that we talk about all the time is like we, over here at One Hit Thunder, we support musicians who just keep going and don't give up. That's why I want to bring it back around to our guest right now. Eric, you're on the show because you were in a band that had some minor success in the 90s with Huff and Moose. You got to have a record release on a major label. It did modestly well on alternative radio. Never got onto the Billboard Hot 100, but you right. got to tour the world. You got to do a documentary that Cameron Crowe said was the greatest rock documentary he's ever seen. But more importantly than all of it, you played Woodstock 94, which here at One Hit Thunder, we think is the end-all, be-all greatest music festival that has ever happened in history.
It's incredible.
We got to talk about this.
I would love to talk about this. This is so cool. I was 14 when Woodstock 94 happened. I believe, now, Eric, I don't know how you feel about this. I believe that 1994 was the greatest year for both music and movies. It's just the year. And that Woodstock 94, I remember a kid. I think they had it on pay-per-view. I think I watched a lot of it scrambled because I couldn't pay for it. So I would just, but you could still hear it. Like, that's the most important part. You couldn't see, maybe you couldn't see the boobs and stuff.
You couldn't see the mud people throwing stuff at Primus and Green Day. But
right. So do you have any cool memories of your experience of that? We're very interested in that over here.
Oh, sure. I'll give you like the condensed version of everything that happened. Let's see. So we get to the site and the way we got into Woodstock 94 was that we won a contest that was sponsored by a local radio station here called WDRE, which was like the alternative rock, station. And it was sponsored by WDRE and Pepsi.
Nice.
So we won this, it was a battle of the bands.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there were some really angry bands that we won because the other bands, like, I'm sure their music was fine and everything, but they looked more like rock bands.
Uh-huh.
We looked like, music nerds, like, kind of like, I've dressed like this my whole life, right. Like maybe a t-shirt.
Right.
And
me too.
Often shorts, and we didn't really look like rock and rollers, but Craig Elkins, the primary songwriter, wrote amazing songs, and it was and the level of musicianship was pretty high in the band because we actually were jazz musicians before we started doing any of this rock and roll stuff.
Nice.
And then I was like, oh, I guess I better learn how to play the music that I grew up on because I, never really refined my rock drumming. So that was the band where I got a chance to do it. But anyway, so we won this contest, and the band formed in March of 1993, and by less than a year and a half later we played Woodstock 94, and by October of 94 we were signed to Interscope. So it was like a year and a half from the first gig we ever played.
That's wild.
To that,
that's fast. That's fast.
It's crazy.
When was, like, it's, I watched your, I want to hear more about this, but I watched your Conan performance. What year was that?
That was January of 1998.
Oh, okay. Okay.
We had this tune Wait.
Yep.
That went to like somewhere in the 30s on the Billboard alternative rock chart.
Awesome.
So I was talking to Kevin, the guitar player. I said, we should do a separate podcast called No Hit Wonders because
I'd be on that too.
Me too. But Yeah, so we get to the site, and we go to this trailer where the Pepsi people were, and they start handing us all this like swag, like Pepsi hats, like a black denim Pepsi vest with like a Woodstock patch on it, and a Pepsi shirt. And they were like, "Yeah, well, you guys are gonna have to wear this stuff when you play."
What? You have to wear Pepsi stuff when you play? That's
yeah. And as sort of hapless as we were from a sartorial perspective, we weren't that stupid. Yeah. So we were like, "No, we're not wearing this." They're like, "Well, if you don't wear it, then you can't play."
What?
So they get on the phone with our attorney in New York City, this guy Jonathan Ehrlich, who represented like Luther Vandross and Madonna and all these people, and then these like schmucks from Philadelphia, and he's like, "It's a Saturday afternoon," and he's like, "Oh, crying out loud." So he's like typing stuff, faxing it to the trailer, addenda to the, you know, and alterations to the contract. Finally, I mean, we were literally not going to play. Finally, they came to an agreement and we didn't have to wear all this crap.
It would be like, let me just throw this out there. If they were like, at least one of you has to wear a Pepsi t-shirt, I feel like that is less ridiculous than, could you imagine a band walking out on stage
in all Pepsi?
Nothing but
Pepsi,
right. Everything.
I'm going to say, Matt, even having to wear one Pepsi t-shirt is kind of ridiculous. I mean,
I'm just saying from a visual standpoint, when you're like, why is the entire band wearing Pepsi?
What is the? I kind of don't even understand what the thing is. Like, that bass player from that band is wearing a Pepsi. Oh, I could really use a Pepsi now that I saw that.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And I mean, I guess the only way it would work is if everybody came out with irony in mind.
Yeah.
The problem is, if nobody knows who you are, they can't put it in that context, and you just look like a bunch of losers. Like,
yeah, I guess that's the other thing. It's
overboard,
like, if Kurt Cobain walked out on the stage wearing a Pepsi shirt, you'd be like, yo, that's so cool.
A full Pepsi outfit. Like, Pepsi pajama pants, Pepsi shirt, like, Pepsi top hat. Yeah, that would be funny. That's what I was going to say.
Clown shoes. Yeah.
Yeah, if they would have demanded, you would have said, well, you got to get us more Pepsi swag if you want us to do this. Yeah.
It's got to be way, way, way over the
top. Yeah, we need the full Pepsi dancers behind us.
Yeah, exactly. So we got over that, and then we went and, you know, it was a rotating stage. So one band was performing, the other band's setting up, and then the stage rotates, and boom, you're on stage. Well, what happened was something happened with the setup, and there was this band before us that was kind of like this I don't know who they were signed to. We were the only unsigned band that played at Woodstock.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And we were on the main stage, which is hilarious.
That's so awesome.
It's like 2 minutes before we're going to go on. And the stage manager says, "Oh, you guys got to play their gear, man. Just go up there and plug in. We don't have time." So I get up there. It was like a 26-inch bass drum with a tom-tom the size of a trash can.
Oh, my God.
And these like horrendous, like, super pingy loud heavy metal cymbals, and like I didn't play like that,
right?
And the only thing I could switch was to my snare drum, so I put my snare drum up, and I mean, I haven't even like gotten set up in, "Ladies and gentlemen, Huffamoose."
Wow.
And I'm like trying to adjust my snare drum, so the guitar player starts playing the intro to the first tune, which opens with like a big buzz roll.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't even have my snare drum snares on yet, so you hear, and then I stop, and then you hear me turn the snares on and play this. And I look at that point, I look out and see like 150,000 people,
wow,
which was approximately 149,800 more people than we'd ever played for. You know what I mean? We were like, holy shit. And so, you know, we played, and the set went by in like a blur. I think people were sort of, there were like five people there that knew who we were. And, you know, one of them was our manager, a guy named Duran Siegel, who's a tremendous human being. He had an old flip phone, speaking of old phones, and he's holding the phone up in the crowd. And he's on the phone with LA record executives. And he's like, "My band's playing the main stage at Woodstock."
Wow.
And he's like holding up his phone. That's actually how we got signed.
That's so awesome. Although at the same time, that's like my worst night. That sounds like a nightmare someone would have. You're going to play in front of 150,000 people, but we're going to throw you on someone else's set. You know, like I can't even imagine. For a drummer, I mean, it'd be bad enough if you were like, you got to use their amps because, you know, that's bad enough. But I can't imagine having to not even get to adjust the drums and set them up. That is crazy, but it's a pretty cool story, man.
It was very, like, I didn't even have time to really think about it, but my drums, I only had one drum set at that time, and it was like a little jazz kit with like an 18-inch bass drum, one mounted tom, and a floor tom. And I used that on like our rock stuff until a friend of mine loaned me enough money to buy a bigger bass drum. So I'm on a drum set. The bass drum, I could have fit my entire kit in that thing. So I'm like, my arms are way up in the air. And like, I mean, it was so uncomfortable, but you didn't really have time to freak out because you're just thinking, oh my God, this is
right.
My career is peaking at 23 years old. Yeah. You know, this is never going to get any better than this. And I'm on like a bizarro heavy metal drum set.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But it was cool. And then we just, you know, we hung out for the whole weekend. And I think one of the highlights for me was in the hospitality tent. Todd Rundgren was in there at the same time. And we were all pretty big Todd Rundgren fans. So I got to talk to him a little bit.
That's cool.
First of all, he's like 11 feet tall. He is so tall. And, you know, he had like straight long hair and he had this kind of somewhat brooding way about him. And it was just surreal to see like a steam table with like Sterno underneath and Todd Rundgren spooning like roasted potatoes onto a paper plate, you know? And I was like, wow, this is like the great equalizer.
Yeah.
we're all eating, you know, out of styrofoam with plastic forks. And here I am with Todd Rundgren. He didn't really want to talk much. He was not a talkative guy, but he was cool though. But it was just being in his presence was pretty exciting at 23 years old. I think I just turned 24.
that's incredible.
So I don't know if the Wikipedia page has the list of bands in proper order, but if we're going to take the list of bands up currently on Wikipedia for Woodstock 94 in order, it was the Goats that played right before you, and then immediately after you was Orleans, a band that we've talked about on this show before.
Really? Orleans played at Woodstock 94? Yeah. Oh, what are their... That was one of
still the one. You're still the one.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
The guy,
and Dance With Me, too. Dance With Me is my favorite of their hits.
Let's just appreciate this lineup immediately after Orleans. Blues Traveler, Jackal.
Jackal with the chainsaw.
Del Armitri, Live, James, King's X, Show Crow, Collective Soul, Candlebox, and then the Violent Femmes closing out the night.
Wow.
Crazy. It was so...
That's awesome. It was
those bands all agreed to close for Huffamoose, which is crazy.
Well, we had a certain type of cachet that they were looking to glom onto, you know?
That's what I started saying. Someone closed for me.
Right.
Closed for my band.
I forget who it was that I heard say that for the first time, but it made me laugh so hard. They were the opening act of the show, and they were like, I want to thank all the other bands for agreeing to close for me tonight.
That's brilliant.
One more thing I want to ask, where I haven't seen it. Is there somewhere that I can watch the Huffamoose doc?
I think it's buying a DVD Amazon, unfortunately.
Okay.
And I don't even think they have it on Amazon anymore. I think we actually have been talking about getting it up on YouTube because it really should just be there. I mean, it's not like anybody's making any money from, you know, this movie. So it's probably going to end up on YouTube. In fact, you're reminding me to pursue that. I mean, I actually found, it's so funny, this is how sad our situation was. This is a burned DVD of the video that my friend's dad made for me like 15 years ago.
Nice.
Because I was like, I don't even have a copy of the movie, but this is, well, let's see if you can see it.
You might have to put it right in front of you. There it is. I see the word Huffamoose.
Yeah, this is the cover. Cool. And, you know, so I have two copies, one burned and one original. Nice.
If you get it up somewhere, I can't wait to see it.
I'll definitely send you a link or I'll find a way to get you a copy because it's definitely worth seeing. It's definitely strange to be in a documentary because I look back on it and I'm like, who is that guy? Like, Why did I say that? Like, that's so weird. Yeah. You know, and maybe that's really who I am. I mean, it's very, very enlightening. Right. It definitely made me reconsider certain things that I would probably never say in public again.
Oh, I know that feeling.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sure. All of us who have played in bands for, you know, decades on decades realize that you've become a different person many times over. I think all your cells regenerate every 7 years or something like that. So it's like you're looking back at a completely different person.
Someone else. Yeah.
But I know. It's still cool. It's still cool to have.
Yeah.
I think it's time to decide whether Thomas Dolby, though, bringing it back around, whether he brought the one hit thunder or he was a one hit blunder. I don't think we said one bad thing about the guy. So I don't know if this is going to be too suspenseful, but I don't know. We could start with you, Eric. You give him the. You gonna throw thunder on his name?
Oh my God! Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, unequivocally, especially because. In some ways, it's kind of unfair to think of him as a one-hit wonder because while he did only have, well, Hyperactive kind of charted to some degree, right?
Sort of. It was actually, Hyperactive was a bigger hit in the UK than She Blinded Me with Science.
Right.
So there's definitely going to be some UK listeners losing their minds about this episode.
But I mean, he has had such... a wide-ranging career from the technology side of things to sideman projects to his solo stuff to his like acoustic thing where he decided he wanted to get at one point in the 2000s completely away from electronics and he made like acoustic records, which are kind of fascinating. So he's really covered a lot of ground. And as a working musician, I really appreciate the kind of labyrinth of his career.
Right.
You know, because it's, you know, very few musicians can, you know, sort of like get launched to the top of the charts and stay there and have a long career like that. And most people that, you know, most guys that I know that got signed in the 80s and 90s, they're like attorneys and, you know, they're small business owners and they're like, oh, my instruments have been in the attic for 30 years.
Right.
But, you know, he just had... I guess because he's such a good musician and such a brilliant thinker, he was able to reinvent himself so many times. So, you know, while this song was kind of emblematic of the one-hit wonder, his career is so diverse and, you know, and he had staying power. And as a musician who, I mean, I make my living playing music, you know, and I appreciate somebody like that who just kept going, you know,
right?
Because it's not easy. It's much easier to kind of like, you know, say, well, we had a good run and now I'm going to get a real job.
Right.
Who wants to do that?
No, I mean, we always talk about how much respect we have for the people that, hey, if I was ever lucky enough to have a big hit song, especially I would appreciate it more now than ever. To be able to be like, that's awesome. That's something I can hang my hat on. Now I'm going to use the resources that I have, be it the money and royalties from that, to be able to, I don't know, build a nice home studio, to be able to buy a touring van, to be able to record music, work with producers, to be able to parlay that into more success. There's nothing... That's my favorite stories always. And we've had some people, Eric, get mad at us when the artists themselves, sometimes we forget that the artists themselves are going to listen to these episodes and then hit us up and be like, what the fuck, man? Like, which has happened several times, but that's been from the artists where they had a hit or they had success. And then it was the next album. It didn't do as well, and then they were out. Then they were done.
Right.
And it's like, why? Why? Yeah. You know, maybe four more albums after. You know, there's some... You look at the stories of Hall & Oates. They had a hit in the mid-70s, and then it was like 5 or 6 more years of putting out albums that didn't do well before they had hits again. You know, like, there's stories like that, too. And, well, hey, you don't always get another hit.
Let's look at like two of the bands that we've become legitimate friends with since doing episodes about them, like 9 Days and Wheatus. Mm-hmm. Both are undeniable one-hit wonders. They have one giant song that everybody knows. And that giant song just can't die. It just keeps popping up over and over and over again. I just saw that literally both of those bands shared the same playlist today on Instagram because the second season of the FX show Cruel Summer is coming out and it's based in the 90s. And they released the official playlist of songs that will be in that season. And both of them have songs. I'm like, this is great, which also... If that second season's a hit, Chris, we can maybe expect some of those episodes to get some listen bumps on our feet.
Nice.
There's always a weird effect that happens with that when a really hit show talks about a song has a song in it that we already talked about.
Yeah, when Pass the Dutchie got played on Stranger Things episode.
Dear Lord.
Episode
we could. But I'm going to agree with Eric on, like, you have to give Thunder here. Mm-hmm. Again, if you hate this song, and I could totally understand someone just being like, this song annoys the absolute piss out of me. Like, just everything that this dude has done with his career from the second this song was a success and the influence that he's had on our in society at large, right? Like, the Nokia ringtones, the music director for TED Talk conferences, like, been over almost a decade of teaching at Johns Hopkins University as part of the Peabody Music Institute. Like, his current course that you could sign up and have him as your professor is the Peabody Music for New Media. Like, he is just constantly thinking of what is the future of this genre, like, of music.
Don't forget the Howard the Duck soundtrack.
The Howard the Duck soundtrack, too. I mean, we didn't even touch on the MIDI file. Like, created MIDI files.
Really? Like, is that true?
Yeah, I think that was part of it. Let me double check my notes. But
no way. If that's true, we should have been talking about that the whole time.
Let me see. I have it in my notes here. In 1996, he was involved in creating audio for web TV. Headspace developed a new downloadable file format designed specifically for internet usage called the Rich Music Format, or the RMF file extension. It was an advantage of small file sizes like MIDI. So he was, like, tied to, like, pushing MIDI to, like, a new file style.
Cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, but that's him. Cool. Like, that's, like, his brain is like, how can we do this and do it better?
Right. Like, so you're throwing thunder on his name, and I would say that I dove into the catalog pretty extensively. I had some stuff to do today, and I had Thomas Dolby playing the whole time. And I saw in 2012, he put out an album where he collaborated with a lot of people, including Regina Spektor and Imogen Heap. And so he's collaborating with, like, more contemporary artists still today. I didn't love everything, I'll be honest. There was some real funky stuff. I think maybe he collaborated with George Clinton on something at some point. And, you know, no, I didn't love every song, but for the most part, I thought it was all really cool. You know, I thought the songs were a little hit or miss. The one thing I will say, if I'm going to say anything bad, some of the songs were kind of forgettable to me. Like, I couldn't remember, like, how did that song go? What was the hook? Even Hyperactive, like, I'm like...
Yeah, I think Hyperactive is a better song ultimately, but I agree with you that there's not as much to latch on to it as Science!
I can't remember the songs that well. That would be the only negative thing I would say, but I gotta throw a thunder on the name of Thomas Dolby as well. I think it's a triple thunder today, and
woo!
I think we knew that was gonna happen. And
I was gonna say, before we go, Eric, is there anywhere, I mean, I know you said that maybe someday soon the documentary will be on YouTube, but in the meantime, is there anywhere where people can keep up with what's going on with you? Maybe even if Huff of Moose is ever working on other things behind the scenes, what's for the future of Eric Johnson?
Well, what's going on now is three of the four people that were in Huff of Moose, we have a band called The Fractals, and we restarted, like, after I quit Huff of Moose after the Horde tour in 1998, and you can find out why in the video. But we, in 2000, Kevin, the guitar player, and Jim, the bass player, and I formed a band that eventually became The Fractals. And we have a tune out right now, and it's been getting a lot of airplay locally on a station in here in Philly called WXPN.
Nice. And, that's the station in Philly. I hear about WXPN all the time, even though I'm in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, they're WYEP.
Oh,
there.
Yeah. You getting some play on WYEP?
Well, they played Huffamoose a lot. I mean, they basically helped us to sell out our shows in Pittsburgh when we would go
that's
on the road.
So cool. I love WYEP there. I've always been very supportive of my band, and I know some of the people there. Great radio station. We had one of the DJs from WYP on here to do The Grateful Dead, which you wouldn't believe were a one hit wonder, but actually they are in their own way. But yes,
Touch of Grey.
Touch of Grey,
right?
Of course. Yeah. But we had Joey Spihar on from WYP.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. So
what a great station. Yep, yeah.
Yep.
But XPN's been playing this song that we have out called Christopher Walken.
Nice.
And the video drops, as the kids say, this Friday. So it will be on, I think our website is changing now. It's going to be like the fractals.band, F-R-A-C-T-A-L-S. And we have like an Instagram thing, a TikTok thing. I don't know all this information with these young kids.
If we know the name of the band, we'll find every everywhere you're at.
That's what's going on now. And we've had a couple of reunion things with Huffamoose. And in fact, we put out a record, I guess three years ago now. It's called And That's When the Golf Ball Hit Me in the Head. And we did it on a small indie label called Winding Way Records, which also the Fractals are on. And then we're the four of us, Craig, the singer, lives in Los Angeles, and he does web design and still writes unbelievably cool music. And then the three of us, like Kevin and Jim, we're like working musicians in Philly. Like, we do a lot of recording sessions for other people and wedding gigs, jazz gigs, corporate stuff, original music for other people. So we're all just, we're basically doing the same thing that we did before Huffamoose when I was 20 years old, which is being a musician. So it was like Huffamoose was like a very fortuitous detour that led us back to being working musicians in the sixth largest market in America. So
hell yeah. That's great, man.
You know,
That's the dream.
So
thanks so much for coming on today, Eric. And
thank you.
Hey, may the cube be with you. That's a song from Thomas Dolby.
Oh, I love it. That's great.
One Hit Thunder. One Hit Thunder is hosted by Chris Vallios of the bands Punchline, Pack, and Another Cheetah, and produced by Matt Kelly of Geekscape.net. Underneath me, you're hearing Eric's band, The Fractals' new single, Christopher Walken. Our podcast is on Patreon now. Find us at patreon.com/OHTpodcast for early access to episodes, bonus episodes, and a chance to vote on future songs for us to cover. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on any podcasting app. And tune in next week for more One Hit Thunder. Christopher Walken, maybe stick with Brando or Pacino or something. Remember when we went to the concert in the tent with the pink acrylic girls from the Lambda Delta?
Apartment.
Let's play.
And we went back to the crib.
The one guy says he knows.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.
I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses, all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles now on Evergreen and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I am Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.